Daniel chapter 11. Chapter 11, naturally, a continuation of chapter 10, but that's not just in a chronological sense, but it really is a continuation in that chapters 10, 11, and 12 of the book of Daniel, they all deal with the same vision. The difference between chapter 10 and chapter 11 is detail. In chapter 11, we see a very detailed record of events, specifics of things to come. Prophecy not yet fulfilled. That is, it wasn't fulfilled in Daniel's time. We have the advantage of history on our side, and much of it, if not actually all of what we're going to talk about tonight, is fulfilled. But we're looking back in time 2,500 years later. So these events in chapter 11, prophecies of things to come, are supercharged with all these details. There's conflict, there's wars and battles, political intrigue, even murders. And all of them are foretold in chapter 11 many years before, in some cases even generations before the events even happened. Chapter 11 spans a period of about 400 years, revealing future events in very specific, exacting details. And scholars say there are 135 prophecies that are given in chapter 11, and all fulfilled as historical fact down to the most minute detail. Chapter 11 brings us to a narrative that sheds more light, or brings a sharper focus on the message that Daniel had received by way of the angel Gabriel. If you remember the message that he received in chapter 9, well, this is the same message that Gabriel carried, and he was delayed for 21 days by the prince of the kingdom of Persia. It is the same message that brought Michael's help as he came to help Gabriel, and there we caught a glimpse into the realm of spiritual warfare as Gabriel was freed to complete his mission and bring the message to Daniel. And that message we saw in Daniel chapter 9 provides Daniel, and it provides us, you and I, with a framework, so to speak, for what would have to happen until the end of time, until the end of days. The message Gabriel carried contained the 70 weeks prophecy in chapter 9, which also contained the promise of the coming of the Messiah. And an interesting side note, it's a prophecy that Satan attempted to keep from, or at least delay its delivery to the prophet Daniel. Now, I know that Satan can't see the future, but he can read, same as you and I, better than you and I, and so he does know what the word says. And he tried to delay that message from coming to Daniel. Something that occurred to me in studying chapter 11 is that I've always heard it said that from the book of Malachi, which concludes the Old Testament, until the Gospel of Matthew, a period of some 400 years elapsed between the Old Testament and the Gospels. And I've always heard that, well, there was no prophet to speak to Israel. It is a period that is referred to as the intertestamental period, the period of time between the Old and New Testaments. The Old Testament book of Malachi includes a prophetic mention of John the Baptist and the coming Messiah. In Malachi chapter 3, verse 1, it reads, "Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord, whom you seek, will suddenly come to his temple, even the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight. Behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts." So in that last book of the Old Testament, in Malachi's prophecies, they had the promise of the coming Messiah. And I've always heard it taught that there was this period of silence following Malachi, that God was silent in his relationship with Israel. But in studying chapter 11 of Daniel, I come to realize there is not as much silence as one might think. That's because Daniel, who was actually a little before Malachi's time, recorded events, prophecy, that would be fulfilled during this intertestamental period. Chapter 11 of Daniel happens, that is, the events in chapter 11, they occurred during this very period of time that supposedly there was no prophet speaking to the nation of Israel. And in chapter 11, there's anything but silence from a prophetic standpoint. The Jews recognized in that day, that is, during this intertestamental period, the prophets had ceased from Israel. When they cleansed the temple after Antiochus Epiphanes' abomination, and you remember Antiochus Epiphanes, he went into the temple and all the horrible things he did, the desecration and all that the Jews suffered at his hands. Well, when they cleansed the temple after the Maccabees drove him out, remember he was a type figure of the Antichrist. Well, when they did that, when they cleansed the temple, they set aside the polluted stones. And they set them aside until a prophet would arise and tell them what to do with them, with those stones which had been defiled. That was in 165 BC, during the intertestamental period, during that time of supposed silence. But more than 400 years before that, the prophet Daniel recorded the events of chapter 11. And in Daniel's time, it was literally pre-written history. History before it happened was recorded. And in that history is the account of Antiochus Epiphanes' abomination in the temple and many other things, as we will see. Israel, the Jews who lived in the period between Malachi and Matthew, did not have a prophet to speak to them. But they had prophets who had spoken to them, as do we. I bring it up because I sometimes wonder what people are thinking, what believers are thinking about where we are in God's time schedule today. Now, I can't say with any certainty how much of that occupies believers' thoughts today. I can say with some accuracy what most people were thinking before Jesus' first coming. I'd say most were preoccupied with life, and except for the most studied, they missed all the signposts. Today, we have the advantage of having the whole counsel of God, the written word, and in it are signposts pointing to tomorrow. The prophet Ezekiel was a contemporary of Daniel. Also, like Daniel, carried off into Babylonian captivity, and like in Daniel, much of the prophetic word in Ezekiel is fulfilled already in our time. Not all, but much is now fulfilled. And the things fulfilled are literally signposts pointing to tomorrow. Yet, like in Daniel, a few things remain to be fulfilled. A few very big, very significant things. In the latter part of Ezekiel, we see the regathering of Israel, the rebirth of Israel as a nation in 1948, a prophecy from 2,500 years ago, fulfilled very dramatically in our time. And as we look at the world news today, we see the increased focus on the Middle East, on Israel, and as of late, on Iran. Persia, to use its biblical name. And not to be left out, there's much, a great deal, in the news about Russia. Now, I'm not taking us off track tonight, but this bears mentioning, and if you'll just bear with me, I think you'll see where it applies to what we're going to be looking at tonight. Especially the things that we see in the news today regarding the geopolitical alliances, military alliances, the abandonment of Israel by former allies, hatred directed at Israel and the Jewish people. All of those are signposts, and as much as they are news today, they were all written in pre-written history by the prophets 2,500 years ago. Case in point, and then we'll get to verse 1 of Daniel chapter 11. Iran, Persia, is vowing, it seems like minute by minute, to destroy Israel. It seems to be their number one aim, that and destroying the United States. And I'm sure you have all heard or seen the hand-wringing over the negotiations ongoing over Iran's nuclear program, their quest for an atomic bomb. And you are all aware that Russia is on the move militarily. Remember, they made their incursions into Crimea, and they are busy in the Ukraine while threatening to do even more. They are conquering and threatening more hostility in the regions of Eastern Europe. It's not an obscure news story. It's daily, with tensions growing more and more acute every day. And all the news outlets, especially cable news, have their analysts to predict what might happen. And analysis and opinion may have their place, but only the word can put it all in proper perspective. As believers, We should filter the news through the Word, giving heed to the prophets who are right on 100% of the time. And as believers, children of God, we should be ready to give a reason for the hope that lies within us. Tonight, right now, Persia is determined to acquire an atomic bomb, and their intent towards Israel is no secret. Russia has, in times past, and now still does, champion Iran's quest by providing a very sophisticated air defense system to Iran. And that makes it difficult for Israel or anyone who's so inclined to attack Iran's nuclear program. And Russia rises to the occasion in the United Nations to run interference for Iran anytime it's needed. And the news analysis is, well, I think if they do this or that, X or Y might happen. But the Bible, your other choice for news, tells us exactly what will happen. The prophecies will be fulfilled. The timing the Lord has reserved for himself to know. We don't know. We don't know times or dates. It could be soon. It could be far away. But we have signposts. Turn with me, if you would, to Ezekiel chapter 38. It's just one book back to your left, if you're in the book of Daniel right now. Chapter 38, and we'll read through verses 1 through 6. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company, with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarma, of the north quarters, and all his bands, and many people with thee. Be thou prepared, and prepare for thyself, thou, and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. This prophecy, not yet fulfilled, is for the latter days, when Israel is back in their land, and the prophecy is directed to Russia and its confederates, naming in verse 5 Persia, or Iran, as part of an invasion of Israel. And as we are seeing in the news every day, Russia, just like it says in the Word, Russia is being a guard for them. Watch in the news. Watch when stories about Persia or Iran come up in the news about their nuclear program. See who runs interference for them. See who sold them the sophisticated air defense system. See who's their champion, who's in their quarter. And then look back 2,500 years and say, it's old news. The Lord wrote it 2,500 years ago. Russia is being a guard for them. And if you really want to know how Israel is going to fare in all of this, the pre-written history is there in chapters 38 and 39, the fulfillment of which is seemingly drawing closer by the day. Recently, I was driving at work and I was listening to talk radio, and the guy that I was listening to, the program I was listening to, is somebody that I like. I won't say who it is, but I like his politics and I like his views on family, and he has a love for this country. And most of what he talks about, with some exception, I agree with. And on any given day, the radio program's topic is naturally driven by the news of the day. What's happened in the last 24 hours? That's what these guys talk about. And they're talking about the current things in the news. And on this particular day, they were talking about a movie which included, I don't know what movie it was, but it was something recently that included a scene or something that had to do with the rapture of the church. Now, these guys have a religious background. They're Mormons, but they're not believers. And as such, their worldview is heavily influenced by religion. Religion being man's futile attempt to reach a holy God, versus ours, a relationship, a holy God's provision to reconcile sinful man through the cross. Anyway, this is what caught my attention. The host of the radio show said these words in response to the others with microphones who obviously don't believe. They were kind of joking around about the idea of the rapture of the church and kind of making fun of it in a light way. Nothing vulgar, but just in bantering back and forth about how could somebody really believe that. And this is what caught my attention. The host of the radio show said these words in response to the others with microphones who don't believe. The host remarked about the rapture of the church, almost as if he was thinking out loud. He said, I wish I could believe that. And then he said, you don't know how much I wish I could believe that. Well, he said that because he's fearful, because he sees the direction that the world is headed. And there are many, many people in the world today that watch the news, and they're scared. They have to be scared, especially if they're not believers, because they're going, where is this headed? But what an opportunity it is for us, especially if you have contact with other people and things come up like this, to know prophecy is such a huge asset, because you can say, I know what's going to happen. I know where you can go to read it. I mean, the prophets have spoken. All of these things, these latter-day prophecies, are coming close now. I mean, we talk about the things that are in the book of Ezekiel or the book of Daniel that we're going through. And you talk about the Gaza in Israel, always in the news because of the insurrection there and the intifadas and the wars that have been fought. You can go to the book of Zephaniah. And there's an incredible study there about the latter-day events in the book of Zephaniah that deal with the Gaza and the land grant that was for the tribe of Judah that they've given up now. They've given it over to the quote-unquote Palestinians. So there's just so much there where you can see the truth. And then you can answer those people who say, you don't know how much I wish that I could believe that. And I too wish he could believe it. And not just that, but that he would come to understand the validity, the 100% accuracy, and the absolute hope that lies between Genesis and Revelation. It reaffirmed for me that prophecy is truly a means of witnessing, not projecting dates or times, but being prepared to share with people current events through the lens of the Bible. People are fascinated by stuff like Nostradamus. And that always amazes me that they're fascinated by somebody like that. What about the real deal prophets of God in the Bible? I mean, what about them? You never hear them mentioned. Maybe that's because the airwaves are controlled by the prince of the power of the air, by Satan. He doesn't want them to know. But that's why we're here, so that they can know. The Apostle Paul wrote to the Thessalonians, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall always be with the Lord." Now that's a prophecy. Okay, I said we'd make it, and we will. Daniel chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. "Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him." This is an angel speaking, by the way, at this point. That's who's doing the talking. "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." So here we are now, we're back to Daniel's lifetime and at the point where the Babylonians have been defeated by the Medes and the Persians. Interesting, isn't it, that 2,500 years goes by and who's back in the news today in 2015? Persia. I mean, that was backwater. That was nothing, you know. Maybe up until the time, I think it was 78 or 79 when the Shah, you know, was expelled from there and the revolution occurred. But that's not that long ago. And prior to that, it was nothing. It was nowhere. So verse 2 tells us, as the angel told Daniel, three Persian kings are in power and the fourth one will be richer than the others. Three kings are going to come, all in a row, so to speak. Each one will succeed the other, and the last, or the fourth king, is going to be very rich, and that by his riches, or because of his riches, he will be able to get the whole kingdom behind him in a quest against Greece. The fourth king they're talking about is identified as Xerxes. And just as was prophesied, he was very rich and he was very powerful, and he set his sights against Greece in the west. Xerxes was very determined, and he raised an army of 2.5 million men over a 4-year period. Some of the sources say it was 2 million men, others say that it was as many as 2.5 million men over this 4-year period. If you're wondering why Xerxes was so preoccupied with attacking the Greeks, the answer in part lies in the reign of the Persian kings before Xerxes. Cyrus and Darius both were involved in forays against the Greek city-states, which drew a lot of Asia Minor into the fight against the Greeks throughout the Mediterranean region. Persian rule over the Greeks was harsh, and the Greek rebellion led to the burning of Sardis, which was the Persian capital in the region. It sparked further battles over a period of about 50 years, and it culminates with Xerxes and his quest to finally destroy the Greeks. There's no shortage of secular history reporting on these events, and as you would expect, history lines up perfectly with the prophecies when you lay them side by side. So Xerxes takes his navy of hundreds of ships and his 2.5 million soldiers, and he crosses the Aegean to a point where he has his engineers make a way for the soldiers to cross the narrow points in the Aegean Sea from Asia Minor to the Greek mainland. Historians say that they used boats in some places to bridge the gaps between the land, and it took a week for the Persian forces to make the trek onto Greek soil. The Greeks fought one of the bloodiest battles in their history against Xerxes and his 2.5 million men. And although history says that Xerxes prevailed, his army was decimated, and as was much of his navy. He retreated back to Persia. 150 years go by, and the Greeks haven't forgot. 150 years later, Greece is poised to take revenge, and it was recorded long before it happened in the book of Daniel, verses 3 and 4. And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others besides those. Well, 150 years after Xerxes' punishing invasion, exactly like the prophecies in Daniel, a mighty king did stand up. That was Alexander the Great. And Alexander was able to unify Greece, the city-states, and he began to conquer, and soon that conquering included Persia. That was the payback. He was 33 years old. His forces had conquered the known world. And as the prophecy says, his kingdom wasn't conquered, but rather broken. As at 33 years old, Alexander dies due to illness. His kingdom was divided, as it says in verse 4, but not to his posterity, not to his sons, his son or his sons, but it was split four ways among four generals. And verse 4 says, his kingdom shall be plucked up. And so it was, with four generals ruling and warring with no unity with one another. Their unifying factor was gone. Alexander, he was dead. He wasn't there to maintain control. And without leadership, things tend to fall into disarray. Of those four generals, two will be the object of our focus tonight. The Ptolemies were in Egypt to the south of Israel, and the Seleucid dynasty in Syria, which is just north, as you know, just north of Israel. Verses 5 and 6. Also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion, and at the end of some years they shall join forces. For the daughter of the king... Verse 6, at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Do you see now the need for laying an encyclopedia right next to the word and to evaluate this one sentence at a time, or maybe a couple of words at a time? Well, verse 5 begins, also the king of the south. So, south of what? The key, of course, is Israel. The Bible, when it refers to north, south, east, west, it's talking about Israel. Israel being the center, basically the center of the world. So, Israel's the key here. And in the Bible, directions are always given from Jerusalem. So, these verses, reference to the king of the south, is a reference to Egypt or Ptolemy. And Ptolemy, in order to avoid fighting with the Syrians in the north, in order to avoid fighting with the Seleucid dynasty up north, he proposes a family unification move by marriage. Well documented in secular writing, here's what happened. The two sides, descending from two of Alexander's generals, they've been warring with one another. They're fighting constantly. That's all they do is fight. That's all they knew under Alexander, was to conquer. So they've been warring back and forth in this seesaw of battles, and Israel is caught in between them and constantly suffering because of the warfare. In an attempt to stop the fighting, the Ptolemies propose... they form an alliance. Verse 6 says, and at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. And that's exactly what happened. Ptolemy, down in Egypt, will give his daughter Berenice to Antiochus in Syria, Antiochus being the king in the north, thus unifying the two dynasties and ending the fighting between them. Great idea. But there's a problem. Antiochus was already married to a gal named Laodice. The solution, he divorces her. He divorces Laodice and he marries Ptolemy's daughter, Berenice. Bad idea, because here's what happened. 2 years go by, and Ptolemy in the south, who started this whole mess, he dies. So Antiochus up north, who married this girl, his daughter, in Syria, he takes back his first wife, Laodice. Again, bad idea. Because Laodice is a little upset over what happened 2 years before. You might say she's a little bent out of shape, because 2 years earlier she was suddenly literally kicked to the curb. And in order to make that clear, she has her own plan now. She kills Antiochus. Some historians say that it was poison. Some accounts say that she stabbed him. Either way, she killed him. He's dead. And that leaves Berenice, the new wife, in an awkward position. One without authority or standing, especially since Antiochus, her husband, is now dead. And it lines up exactly with the prophecies, as verse 6 says, that she shall not retain the power of her authority. She had power. She had authority when her husband was alive. He was the king. He was the ruler. He's now been murdered. Her husband, the king, is dead, and now she's an outsider, unable to retain the power of her authority. She can say she has authority, but saying and doing are two different things. Laodice, the first wife of Antiochus, orders Berenice and her infant son, whom Berenice had with Antiochus, to be killed, along with her servants. And having done so, she puts her own son on the throne. Verses 7 through 9. But from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them, and prevail. Verse 8, and he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt, with their princes, and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Also, the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. But from a branch of her roots. What branch and whose roots are they talking about? That would be the late Berenice's roots, and the branch is her brother. Berenice's brother in the south. That's Ptolemy the Third, actually. And he's furious at the murder of his sister. So he marches his army through Israel, poor Israel, they bear the brunt of all of this, and into Syria, and he defeats the Syrians. He takes back some 2,500 idols, false gods, the Syrians had taken in previous times in battles with the Egyptians. Again, all of this is documented in the secular writings too, in the historical writings. As a matter of fact, some of the secular writings get down into how much gold there was, how much it weighed, what it was worth in that day, and all that kind of stuff. So, again, naturally the scriptures are right on. News written before it happened. Verse 10. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. Verse 10 is the counterattack against Egypt, the Ptolemies, the payback for the attack on the north, and in retaliation for the loot the south took back to Egypt, which was really their stuff to begin with. During this incursion to the south, Antiochus claimed Israel as his. More suffering for Israel, again, caught in the middle. Verses 11 and 12. In verses 11 and 12, the angel tells Daniel that the king of the south shall be moved with rage. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude. But the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. By the way, that cast down tens of thousands, that's talking about people being killed. Tens of thousands that were slain. The angel tells Daniel the king of the south will attack and meet a great multitude of soldiers from the king of the north, but that the great multitude of soldiers from the north will be given into his hand. This was fulfilled when Antiochus III from the north was defeated at the Battle of Raphia. Because he was defeated, he lost his dominion of Israel's land. Remember, he had claimed it before. Well, now he's lost it again. The north is defeated, but as the prophecy reads in the very last part of verse 12, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. The Egyptian king didn't follow up on his victory by strengthening his position. Verses 13 and 14. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. This time the north comes really ready to do business. Now in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south, also violent men of your people in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So verse 13 tells us the king of the north, Antiochus, comes back again, this time with an even bigger army and more stuff, more equipment. And verse 14 continues that in those times, or in that day, many will rise up against the south. A reference, at least in part, to the Israelis who helped the northern army, along with the Greeks, namely Philip of Macedonia, who Antiochus, and by the way, Philip of Macedonia, when you look, you know, Alexander the Great's father was Philip of Macedonia, but this is not, obviously, this is not the same person that we're talking about. He's basically the, basically he went to Greece and he enlisted the support of the Greek army at the time. And Antiochus persuaded them to come and help. The angel told Daniel that the northern dynasty would answer back and defeat the king of the south in this extended siege. The victory will give the king of the north dominion over the glorious land. The glorious land being Israel. And it was fulfilled exactly as was prophesied in Daniel. Antiochus III gained final control over the armies of the Ptolemy, it's actually Ptolemy V, and over Israel, the glorious land. The Jews helped Antiochus because they resented the Ptolemies of Egypt. But it turned out bad for Israel as they suffered immeasurably at the hand of Antiochus III, who they first viewed as a liberator, but he was anything but a liberator. Israel's history is not without bad choices, and their future is not without some bad choices to come. Verse 15. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. This again is connected, obviously, to the last verse. This again is a reference to the last verse, the last few verses detailing the overwhelming force that Antiochus brought against the south. Verse 16 ending with the reference to the glorious land, or Israel. Verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be with him. This is the last, I think this is the last verse in the interest of time tonight that we'll go through. Also, as we finish these next couple of verses, we're bumping up against the point where Antiochus Epiphanes enters onto the scene. And you know, Antiochus Epiphanes was a type figure of the Antichrist. And so next time that we meet, we'll finish chapter 11. I think this is a good breaking point, these next few verses, because we kind of shift gears in the latter part of chapter 11. So again, verse 15, so the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound, take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. Again, a reference to the overwhelming superiority the north has now brought to conquer the south, the king of Egypt at the time. Verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of woman to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. Well, now this is a guy by the name of Euergetes. I'm guessing that is how to pronounce this, of the Ptolemy line, is the king of the south in Egypt. And at the time, this verse is referring to somebody who at the time, he was the king of the south, but he was just a figurehead. He was a little kid. But he was the rightful heir to the throne at the time. And but he was just a child, so obviously other people were running the kingdom. But he is the king, and he has the right to the throne. And in the north, Antiochus, who is actually called Antiochus the Great, he sends his daughter south. His daughter's name was Cleopatra. And he made a pact or a deal that she and the young king get married when he grows up. This again is one of those things where you got the two kingdoms that are always warring, and now he's going to send his daughter down there to marry the king when he grows up. But in this particular case, it appears as if Antiochus the Great does so thinking, now I've got somebody on the inside. You know, not maybe necessarily a spy, but somebody who can provide influence in the southern kingdom that's going to benefit him in the north. So he sends his daughter south, his daughter Cleopatra, and he makes a deal, and she's going to marry the king when he grows up. In the meantime, Cleopatra is going to be Antiochus the Great's insider in the southern kingdom. But, like the prophecy said, she shall not stand with him or before him. Antiochus figured wrongly that his daughter would be his influence in another kingdom, a kingdom that they had been at perpetual war with. She did marry the guy. She marries him as planned, but she always sided with her husband. I think she literally loved her husband and fell in love with him. I read a little bit of Pastor Chuck's commentary on this tonight before we came, and it was just a tiny little bit, but it was about this one particular verse. And he said that Antiochus should have read his Bible before he made his plan. Amen to that. So anyway, I think we'll close with that, and we'll pick up again. The rest of chapter 11 is truly fascinating. It gives us insight. You know, I really don't believe that we need to know anything about the Antichrist other than we know that he'll come someday. What the Word allows us to know, I don't believe that we'll be here to see him, but it does give some fascinating insight into what he'll be like as we continue on through our study of Daniel. So with that, we'll close.